as we have grown up to expect. 1G is the acceleration experienced by falling objects on the Earth almost 10 meters per second every second. A falling rock will reach a speed of 10 meters per second after 1 second of fall, 20 meters per second after 2 seconds, and so on, until it strikes the ground or is slowed by friction with the air. The animals and plants on Earth and the structures of our buildings are all evolved or designed for 1G. If the gravity were much less, there might be tall, spindly shapes that would not be tumbled or crushed by their own weight. If the gravity were much more, plants and animals and architecture would have to be short and squat and sturdy in order not to collapse. But even in a fairly strong gravity field, light would travel in a straight line, as it does, of course, in everyday life. Consider a possibly typical group of Earth beings at the tea party from Alice in Wonderland. As we lower the gravity, things weigh less. Near 0G, the slightest motion sends our friends floating and tumbling up in the air. Spilled tea, or any other liquid, forms throbbing spherical globs in the air. The surface tension of the liquid overwhelms gravity. Balls of tea are everywhere. If now we dial 1G again, we make a rain of tea. When we increase the gravity a little, from 1G to, say, 3 or 4Gs, everyone becomes immobilized. Even moving a paw requires enormous effort. As a kindness, we remove our friends from the domain of the gravity machine before we dial higher gravities still. The beam from a lantern travels in a perfectly straight line, as nearly as we can see, at a few G's as it does at 0G. At 1,000 G's, the beam is still straight, but trees have become squashed and flattened. At 100,000 G's, rocks are crushed by their own weight. Eventually, nothing at all survives except through a special dispensation, the Cheshire Cat. When the gravity approaches a billion G's, something still more strange happens. The beam of light, which has until now been heading straight up into the sky, is beginning to bend. Under extremely strong gravitational accelerations, even light is affected. If we increase the gravity still more, the light is pulled back to the ground near us. Now, the cosmic Cheshire Cat has vanished, only its gravitational grin remains. When the gravity is sufficiently high, nothing, not even light, can get out. Such a place is called a black hole. Enigmatically, indifferent to its surroundings, it's a kind of cosmic Cheshire Cat. When the density and gravity become sufficiently high, the black hole winks out and disappears from our universe. That is why it is called black. No light can escape from it. On the inside, because the light is trapped down there, things may be attractively well lit. Even if a black hole is invisible from the outside, its gravitational presence can be palpable. If, on an interstellar voyage, you are not paying attention, you can find yourself drawn into it irrevocably, your body stretched unpleasantly into a long, thin thread. But the matter accreting into a disk surrounding the black hole would be a sight worth remembering, in the unlikely case that you survived the trip. Thermonuclear reactions in the solar interior support the outer layers of the sun and postpone for billions of years a catastrophic gravitational collapse. For white dwarfs, the pressure of the electrons stripped from their nuclei holds the star up. For neutron stars, the pressure of the neutrons staves off gravity, but for an elderly star left after supernova explosions and other impetuosities with more than several times the sun's mass, there are no forces known that can prevent collapse. The star shrinks incredibly, spins, reddens, and disappears. A star 20 times the mass of the sun will shrink until it is the size of Greater Los Angeles. The crushing gravity becomes 10 to the 10th power G's, and the star slips through a self-generated crack in the space-time continuum and vanishes from our universe. Black holes were first thought of by the English astronomer John Michell in 1783. but the idea seemed so bizarre that it was generally ignored until quite recently. Then, to the astonishment of many, including many astronomers, evidence was actually found for the existence of black holes in space. The Earth's atmosphere is opaque to X-rays. To determine whether astronomical objects emit such short wavelengths of light, an X-ray telescope must be carried aloft. The first X-ray observatory was an admirably international effort, orbited by the United States from an Italian launch platform in the Indian Ocean off the coast of Kenya and named Uhuru, the Swahili word for freedom. In 1971, Uhuru discovered a remarkably bright X-ray source in the constellation of Cygnus, the Swan, flickering on and off 1,000 times a second. The source, called Cygnus X-1, must therefore be very small. Whatever the reason for the flicker, information on when to turn on and off can cross Sig X-1 no faster than the speed of light, 300,000 kilometers per second. Thus, Sig X-1 can be no larger than 300,000 kilometers per second times 1/1000th of a second, equaling 300 kilometers across. Something the size of an asteroid is a brilliant, blinking source of X-rays visible over interstellar distances. What could it possibly be? Sig X-1 is in precisely the same place in the sky as a hot blue supergiant star, which reveals itself in visible light to have a massive, close but unseen companion that gravitationally tugs it first in one direction and then in another. The companion's mass is about 10 times that of the Sun. The supergiant is an unlikely source of X-rays, and it is tempting to identify the companion inferred in visible light with the source detected in X-ray light. But an invisible object weighing 10 times more than the Sun and collapsed into a volume the size of an asteroid can only be a black hole. The X-rays are plausibly generated by friction in the disk of gas and dust accreted around Sig X-1 from its supergiant companion. Other stars called V861 Scorpii, GX339-4, SS433, and Circinus X2 are also candidate black holes. Cassiopeia A is the remnant of a supernova whose light should have reached the Earth in the 17th century, when there were a fair number of astronomers, yet no one reported the explosion. Perhaps, as I.S. Shklovsky has suggested, there is a black hole hiding there, which ate the exploding stellar core and damped the fires of the supernova. Telescopes in space are the means for checking these shards and fragments of data that may be the spoor, the trail, of the legendary black hole. A helpful way to understand black holes is to think about the curvature of space. Consider a flat, flexible, lined, two-dimensional surface, like a piece of graph paper made of rubber. If we drop a small mass, the surface is deformed or puckered. A marble rolls around the pucker in an orbit like that of a planet around the Sun. In this interpretation, which we owe to Einstein, gravity is a distortion in the fabric of space. In our example, we see two-dimensional space warped by mass into a third physical dimension. Imagine we live in a three-dimensional universe, locally distorted by matter into a fourth physical dimension that we cannot perceive directly. The greater the local mass, the more intense the local gravity, and the more severe the pucker, distortion, or warp of space. In this analogy, a black hole is a kind of bottomless pit. What happens if you fall in? As seen from the outside, you would take an infinite amount of time to fall in, because all your clocks, mechanical and biological, would be perceived as having stopped. But from your point of view, all your clocks would be ticking away normally. If you could somehow survive the gravitational tides and radiation flux, and a likely assumption, if the black hole were rotating, it is just possible that you might emerge in another part of space-time, somewhere else in space, somewhen else in time. Such wormholes in space, a little like those in an apple, have been seriously suggested, although they have by no means been proved to exist. Might gravity tunnels provide a kind of interstellar or intergalactic subway, permitting us to travel to inaccessible places much more rapidly than we could in the ordinary way? Can black holes serve as time machines, carrying us to the remote past or the distant future? The fact that such ideas are being discussed, even semi-seriously, shows how surreal the universe may be. We are, in the most profound sense, children of the cosmos. Think of the sun's heat on your upturned face on a cloudless summer's day. Think how dangerous it is to gaze at the sun directly. From 150 million kilometers away, we recognize its power. What would we feel on its seething, self-luminous surface or immersed in its heart of nuclear fire? The sun warms us and feeds us and permits us to see. It fecundated the earth. It is powerful beyond human experience. Birds greet the sunrise with an audible ecstasy. Even some one-celled organisms know to swim to the light. Our ancestors worshipped the sun, and they were far from foolish. And yet the sun is an ordinary, even a mediocre, star. If we must worship a power greater than ourselves, does it not make sense to revere the sun and stars? Hidden within every astronomical investigation, sometimes so deeply buried that the researcher himself is unaware of its presence, lies a kernel of awe. The galaxy is an unexplored continent filled with exotic beings of stellar dimensions. We have made a preliminary reconnaissance and have encountered some of the inhabitants. A few of them resemble beings we know. Others are bizarre beyond our most unconstrained fantasies. But we are at the very beginning of our exploration. Past voyages of discovery suggest that many of the most interesting inhabitants of the galactic continent remain as yet unknown and unanticipated. Not far outside the galaxy, there are almost certainly planets orbiting stars in the Magellanic Clouds and in the globular clusters that surround the Milky Way. Such worlds would offer a breathtaking view of the galaxy rising, an enormous spiral form comprising 400 billion stellar inhabitants, with collapsing gas clouds, condensing planetary systems, luminous supergiants, stable middle-aged stars, red giants, white dwarfs, planetary nebulae, novae, supernovae, neutron stars, and black holes. It would be clear from such a world, as it is beginning to be clear from ours, how our matter, our form, and much of our character is determined by the deep connection between life and the cosmos. Chapter 10, The Edge of Forever. There is a way on high, conspicuous in the clear heavens, called the Milky Way, brilliant with its own brightness. By it, the gods go to the dwelling of the great Thunderer and his royal abode. Here, the famous and mighty inhabitants of heaven have their homes. This is the region which I might make bold to call the Palatine Way of the great sky. Ovid, Metamorphoses, Rome, 1st century. Some foolish men declare that a creator made the world. The doctrine that the world was created is ill-advised and should be rejected. If God created the world, where was he before creation? How could God have made the world without any raw material? If you say he made this first and then the world, you are faced with an endless regression. No, that the world is uncreated, as time itself is, without beginning and end. And it is based on the principles. The Mahapurana, the great legend. Janasana, India, 9th century. 10 or 20 billion years ago, something happened. The Big Bang, the event that began our universe. Why it happened is the greatest mystery we know. That it happened is reasonably clear. All the matter and energy now in the universe was concentrated at extremely high density, a kind of cosmic egg reminiscent of the creation myths of many cultures, perhaps into a mathematical point with no dimensions at all. It was not that all the matter and energy were squeezed into a minor corner of the present universe. Rather, the entire universe, matter and energy, and the space they fill, occupied a very small volume. There was not much room for events to happen in. In that titanic cosmic explosion, the universe began an expansion, which has never ceased. It is misleading to describe the expansion of the universe as a sort of distending bubble viewed from the outside. By definition, nothing we can ever know about was outside. It is better to think of it from the inside, perhaps with grid lines, imagined to adhere to the moving fabric of space, expanding uniformly in all directions. As space stretched, the matter and energy in the universe expanded with it and rapidly cooled. The radiation of the cosmic fireball, which then as now filled the universe, moved through the spectrum, from gamma rays to X-rays to ultraviolet light, through the rainbow colors of the visible spectrum, into the infrared and radio regions. The remnants of that fireball, the cosmic background radiation emanating from all parts of the sky, can be detected by radio telescopes today. In the early universe, space was brilliantly illuminated. As time passed, the fabric of space continued to expand, the radiation cooled, and in ordinary visible light, for the first time, space became dark as it is today. The early universe was filled with radiation and a plenum of matter, originally hydrogen and helium, formed from elementary particles in the dense primeval fireball. There was very little to see, if there had been anyone around to do the seeing. Then, little pockets of gas, small non-uniformities, began to grow. Tendrils of vast gossamer gas clouds formed, colonies of great, lumbering, slowly spinning things, steadily brightening, each a kind of beast, eventually to contain 100 billion shining points. The largest recognizable structures in the universe had formed. We see them today. We ourselves inhabit some lost corner of one. We call them galaxies. About 1 billion years after the Big Bang, the distribution of matter in the universe had become a little lumpy, perhaps because the Big Bang itself had not been perfectly uniform. Matter was more densely compacted in these lumps than elsewhere. Their gravity drew to them substantial quantities of nearby gas, growing clouds of hydrogen and helium that were destined to become clusters of galaxies. A very small initial non-uniformity suffices to produce substantial condensations of matter later on. As the gravitational collapse continued, the primordial galaxies spun increasingly faster because of the conservation of angular momentum. Some flattened, squashing themselves along the axis of rotation where gravity is not balanced by centrifugal force. These became the first spiral galaxies, great rotating pinwheels of matter in open space. Other proto-galaxies with weaker gravity or less initial rotation flattened very little and became the first elliptical galaxies. There are similar galaxies, as if stamped from the same mold, all over the cosmos, because these simple laws of nature, gravity, and the conservation of angular momentum are the same all over the universe. The physics that works for falling bodies and pirouetting ice skaters down here in the microcosm of the Earth make galaxies up there in the macrocosm of the universe. Within the nascent galaxies, much smaller clouds were also experiencing gravitational collapse. Interior temperatures became very high. Thermonuclear reactions were initiated, and the first stars turned on. The hot, massive young stars evolved rapidly, profligates, carelessly spending their capital of hydrogen fuel, soon ending their lives in brilliant supernova explosions, returning thermonuclear ash, helium, carbon, oxygen, and heavier elements to the interstellar gas for subsequent generations of star formation. Supernova explosions of massive early stars produced successive overlapping shockwaves in the adjacent gas, compressing the intergalactic medium and accelerating the generation of clusters of galaxies. Gravity is opportunistic, amplifying even small condensations of matter. Supernova shockwaves may have contributed to accretions of matter at every scale. The epic of cosmic evolution had begun. A hierarchy in the condensation of matter from the gas of the Big Bang, clusters of galaxies, stars, planets, and, eventually, life, and an intelligence able to understand a little of the elegant process responsible for its origin. Clusters of galaxies fill the universe today. Some are insignificant, paltry collections of a few dozen galaxies. The affectionately titled Local Group contains only two large galaxies of any size, both spirals, the Milky Way and M31. Other clusters run to immense hordes of thousands of galaxies in mutual gravitational embrace. There is some hint that the Virgo cluster contains tens of thousands of galaxies. On the largest scale, we inhabit a universe of galaxies, perhaps 100 billion exquisite examples of cosmic architecture and decay, with order and disorder equally evident, normal spirals turned at various angles to our earthly line of sight. Face on, we see the spiral arms, edge on, the central lanes of gas and dust in which the arms are formed. Barred spirals, with a river of gas and dust and stars running through the center, connecting the spiral arms on opposite sides. Stately, giant, elliptical galaxies containing more than a trillion stars which have grown so large because they have swallowed and merged with other galaxies. A plethora of dwarf ellipticals, the galactic midges, each containing some paltry millions of suns. An immense variety of mysterious irregulars, indications that in the world of galaxies, there are places where something has gone ominously wrong. And galaxies orbiting each other so closely that their edges are bent by the gravity of their companions, and in some cases, streamers of gas and stars are drawn out gravitationally, a bridge between the galaxies. Some clusters have their galaxies arranged in an unambiguously spherical geometry. They are composed chiefly of ellipticals, often dominated by one giant elliptical, the presumptive galactic cannibal. Other clusters with a far more disordered geometry have comparatively many more spirals and irregulars. Galactic collisions distort the shape of an originally spherical cluster and may also contribute to the genesis of spirals and irregulars from ellipticals. The form and abundance of the galaxies have a story to tell us of ancient events on the largest possible scale, a story we are just beginning to read. The development of high-speed computers makes possible numerical experiments on the collective motion of thousands or tens of thousands of points, each representing a star, each under the gravitational influence of all the other points. In some cases, spiral arms form all by themselves in a galaxy that has already flattened to a disk. Occasionally, a spiral arm may be produced by the close gravitational encounter of two galaxies, each, of course, composed of billions of stars. The gas and dust diffusely spread through such galaxies will collide and become warmed. But when two galaxies collide, the stars pass effortlessly by one another, like bullets through a swarm of bees, because a galaxy is made mostly of nothing and the spaces between the stars are vast. Nevertheless, the configuration of the galaxies can be distorted severely. A direct impact on one galaxy by another can send the constituent stars pouring and careening through intergalactic space, a galaxy wasted. When a small galaxy runs into a larger one, face on, it can produce one of the loveliest of the rare irregulars, a ring galaxy, thousands of light years across, set against the velvet of intergalactic space. It is a splash in the galactic pond, a temporary configuration of disrupted stars, a galaxy with a central piece torn out. The unstructured blobs of irregular galaxies, the arms of spiral galaxies, and the torus of ring galaxies exist for only a few frames in the cosmic motion picture, then dissipate, often to be reformed again. Our sense of galaxies as ponderous, rigid bodies is mistaken. They are fluid structures with 100 billion stellar components. Just as a human being, a collection of 100 trillion cells is typically in a steady state between synthesis and decay and is more than the sum of its parts, so also is a galaxy. The suicide rate among galaxies is high. Some nearby examples, tens or hundreds of millions of light years away, are powerful sources of X-rays. Infrared radiation and radio waves have extremely luminous cores and fluctuate in brightness on timescales of weeks. Some display jets of radiation, 1,000 light-year-long plumes, and disks of dust in substantial disarray. These galaxies are blowing themselves up. Black holes ranging from millions to billions of times more massive than the Sun are suspected in the cores of giant elliptical galaxies such as NGC 6251 and M87. There is something very massive, very dense, and very small ticking and purring inside M87 from a region smaller than the solar system. A black hole is implicated. Billions of light years away are still more tumultuous objects, the quasars, which may be the colossal explosions of young galaxies, the mightiest events in the history of the universe since the Big Bang itself. The word quasar is an acronym for quasi-stellar radio source. After it became clear that not all of them were powerful radio sources, they were called QSOs, quasi-stellar objects. Because they are star-like in appearance, they were naturally thought to be stars within our own galaxy. But spectroscopic observations of their redshift show them likely to be immense distances away. They seem to partake vigorously in the expansion of the universe, some receding from us at more than 90% the speed of light. If they are very far, they must be intrinsically extremely bright to be visible over such distances. Some are as bright as 1,000 supernovae exploding at once. Just as for Sig X1, their rapid fluctuations show their enormous brightness to be confined to a very small volume. In this case, less than the size of a solar system. Some remarkable process must be responsible for the vast outpouring of energy in a quasar. Among the proposed explanations are, 1, quasars are monster versions of pulsars with a rapidly rotating supermassive core connected to a strong magnetic field. 2, quasars are due to multiple collisions of millions of stars densely packed into the galactic core, tearing away the outer layers and exposing to full view the billion-degree temperatures of the interiors of massive stars. 3. A related idea, quasars are galaxies in which the stars are so densely packed that a supernova explosion in one will rip away the outer layers of another and make it a supernova, producing a stellar chain reaction. 4. Quasars are powered by the violent mutual annihilation of matter and antimatter, somehow preserved in the quasar until now. 5. A quasar is the energy released when gas and dust and stars fall into an immense black hole in the core of such a galaxy, perhaps itself the product of ages of collision and coalescence of smaller black holes. And 6. Quasars are white holes, the other side of black holes, a funneling and eventual emergence into view of matter pouring into a multitude of black holes in other parts of the universe or even in other universes. In considering the quasars, we confront profound mysteries. Whatever the cause of a quasar explosion, one thing seems clear. Such a violent event must produce untold havoc. In every quasar explosion, millions of worlds, some with life and the intelligence to understand what is happening, may be utterly destroyed. The study of the galaxies reveals a universal order and beauty. It also shows us chaotic violence on a scale hitherto undreamed of. That we live in a universe which permits life is remarkable. That we live in one which destroys galaxies and stars and worlds is also remarkable. The universe seems neither benign nor hostile, merely indifferent to the concerns of such puny creatures as we. Even a galaxy, so seemingly well-mannered as the Milky Way, has its stirrings and its dances. Radio observations show two enormous clouds of hydrogen gas, enough to make millions of suns, plummeting out from the galactic core, as if a mild explosion happened there every now and then. A high-energy astronomical observatory in Earth orbit has found the galactic core to be a strong source of a particular gamma-ray spectral line, consistent with the idea that a massive black hole is hidden there. Galaxies, like the Milky Way, may represent the staid Middle Age in a continuous evolutionary sequence, which encompasses, in their violent adolescence, quasars and exploding galaxies. Because the quasars are so distant, we see them in their youth as they were billions of years ago. The stars of the Milky Way move with systematic grace. Globular clusters plunge through the galactic plane and out the other side, where they slow, reverse, and hurtle back again. If we could follow the motion of individual stars bobbing about the galactic plane, they would resemble a froth of popcorn. We have never seen a galaxy change its form significantly only because it takes so long to move. The Milky Way rotates once every quarter billion years. If we were to speed the rotation, we would see that the galaxy is a dynamic, almost organic entity, in some ways resembling a multicellular organism. Any astronomical photograph of a galaxy is merely a snapshot of one stage in its ponderous motion and evolution. The inner region of a galaxy rotates as a solid body, but beyond that, like the planets around the Sun following Kepler's third law, the outer provinces rotate progressively more slowly. The arms have a tendency to wind up around the core in an ever-tightening spiral, and gas and dust accumulate in spiral patterns of greater density, which are in turn the locales for the formation of young, hot, bright stars, the stars that outline the spiral arms. These stars shine for 10 million years or so, a period corresponding to only 5% of a galactic rotation. But as the stars that outline a spiral arm burn out, new stars and their associated nebulae are formed just behind them, and the spiral pattern persists. The stars that outline the arms do not survive even a single galactic rotation. Only the spiral pattern remains. The speed of any given star around the center of the galaxy is generally not the same as that of the spiral pattern. The Sun has been in and out of spiral arms often in the 20 times it has gone around the Milky Way at 200 kilometers per second, roughly 500,000 miles per hour. On the average, the Sun and the planets spend 40 million years in a spiral arm, 80 million outside, another 40 million in, and so on. Spiral arms outline the region where the latest crop of newly hatched stars is being formed, but not necessarily where such middle-aged stars as the Sun happen to be. In this epoch, we live between spiral arms. The periodic passage of the solar system through spiral arms may conceivably have had important consequences for us. About 10 million years ago, the Sun emerged from the Gould Belt complex of the Orion Spiral Arm, which is now a little less than 1,000 light-years away. Interior to the Orion Arm is the Sagittarius Arm. Beyond the Orion Arm is the Perseus Arm. When the Sun passes through a spiral arm, it is more likely than it is at present to enter into gaseous nebulae and interstellar dust clouds and to encounter objects of substellar mass. It has been suggested that the major ice ages on our planet, which recur every 100 million years or so, may be due to the interposition of interstellar matter between the Sun and the Earth. W. Napier and S. Klube have proposed that a number of the moons, asteroids, comets, and circumplanetary rings in the solar system once freely wandered in interstellar space until they were captured as the Sun plunged through the Orion spiral arm. This is an intriguing idea, although perhaps not very likely. But it is testable. All we need do is procure a sample of, say, Phobos or a comet and examine its magnesium isotopes. The relative abundance of magnesium isotopes, all sharing the same number of protons but having differing numbers of neutrons, depends on the precise sequence of stellar nucleosynthetic events, including the timing of nearby supernova explosions that produced any particular sample of magnesium. In a different corner of the galaxy, a different sequence of events should have occurred and a different ratio of magnesium isotopes should prevail. The discovery of the Big Bang and the recession of the galaxies came from a commonplace of nature called the Doppler effect. We are used to it in the physics of sound. An automobile driver speeding by us blows his horn. Inside the car, the driver hears a steady blare at a fixed pitch. But outside the car, we hear a characteristic change in pitch. To us, the sound of the horn elides from high frequencies to low. A racing car traveling at 200 kilometers per hour, 120 miles per hour, is going almost one-fifth the speed of sound. Sound is a succession of waves in air, a crest and a trough, a crest and a trough. The closer together the waves are, the higher the frequency or pitch. The farther apart the waves are, the lower the pitch. If the car is racing away from us, it stretches out the sound waves, moving them from our point of view to a lower pitch and producing the characteristic sound with which we are all familiar. If the car were racing toward us, the sound waves would be squashed together, the frequency would be increased, and we would hear a high-pitched wail. If we knew what the ordinary pitch of the horn was when the car was at rest, we could deduce its speed blindfolded from the change in pitch. Light is also a wave. Unlike sound, it travels perfectly well through a vacuum. The Doppler effect works here as well. If, instead of sound, the automobile were for some reason emitting front and back a beam of pure yellow light, the frequency of the light would increase slightly as the car approached and decrease slightly as the car receded. At ordinary speeds, the effect would be imperceptible. If, however, the car were somehow traveling at a good fraction of the speed of light, we would be able to observe the color of the light changing toward higher frequency, that is, toward blue as the car approached us, and toward lower frequencies, that is, toward red as the car receded from us. An object approaching us at very high velocities is perceived to have the color of its spectral lines blue-shifted. An object receding from us at very high velocities has its spectral lines red-shifted. This red shift, observed in the spectral lines of distant galaxies and interpreted as a Doppler effect, is the key to cosmology. During the early years of this century, the world's largest telescope, destined to discover the redshift of remote galaxies, was being built on Mount Wilson, overlooking what were then the clear skies of Los Angeles. Large pieces of the telescope had to be hauled to the top of the mountain, a job for mule teams. A young mule skinner named Milton Humason helped to transport mechanical and optical equipment, scientists, engineers, and dignitaries up the mountain. Humason would lead the column of mules on horseback, his white terrier standing just behind the saddle, its front paws on Humason's shoulders. He was a tobacco-chewing roustabout, a superb gambler and pool player, and what was then called a ladies' man. In his formal education, he had never gone beyond the eighth grade, but he was bright and curious and naturally inquisitive about the equipment he had laboriously carted to the heights. Humason was keeping company with the daughter of one of the observatory engineers, a man who harbored reservations about his daughter seeing a young man who had no higher ambition than to be a mule skinner. So Humason took odd jobs at the observatory: electrician's assistant, janitor, swabbing the floors of the telescope he had helped to build. One evening, so the story goes, the night telescope assistant fell ill, and Humason was asked if he might fill in. He displayed such skill and care with the instruments that he soon became a permanent telescope operator and observing aide. After World War I, there came to Mount Wilson the soon-to-be-famous Edwin Hubble, brilliant, polished, gregarious, outside the astronomical community, with an English accent acquired during a single year as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. It was Hubble who provided the final demonstration that the spiral nebulae were in fact island universes, distant aggregations of enormous numbers of stars, like our own Milky Way galaxy. He had figured out the stellar standard candle required to measure the distances to the galaxies. Hubble and Humason hit it off splendidly, a perhaps unlikely pair who worked together at the telescope harmoniously. Following a lead by the astronomer V.M. Slipher at Lowell Observatory, they began measuring the spectra of distant galaxies. It soon became clear that Humason was better able to obtain high-quality spectra of distant galaxies than any professional astronomer in the world. He became a full staff member of the Mount Wilson Observatory, learned many of the scientific underpinnings of his work, and died rich in the respect of the astronomical community. The light from a galaxy is the sum of the light emitted by the billions of stars within it. As the light leaves these stars, certain frequencies or colors are absorbed by the atoms in the star's outermost layers. The resulting lines permit us to tell that stars millions of light years away contain the same chemical elements as our sun and the nearby stars. Humason and Hubble found, to their amazement, that the spectra of all the distant galaxies are redshifted, and, still more startling, that the more distant the galaxy was, the more redshifted were its spectral lines. The most obvious explanation of the redshift was in terms of the Doppler effect. The galaxies were receding from us. The more distant the galaxy, the greater its speed of recession. But why should the galaxies be fleeing us? Could there be something special about our location in the universe, as if the Milky Way had performed some inadvertent but offensive act in the social life of galaxies? It seemed much more likely that the universe itself was expanding, carrying the galaxies with it. Humason and Hubble, it gradually became clear, had discovered the Big Bang, if not the origin of the universe, then at least its most recent incarnation. Almost all of modern cosmology, and especially the idea of an expanding universe and a Big Bang, is based on the idea that the redshift of distant galaxies is a Doppler effect and arises from their speed of recession. But there are other kinds of redshifts in nature. There is, for example, the gravitational redshift, in which the light leaving an intense gravitational field has to do so much work to escape that it loses energy during the journey. The process, perceived by a distant observer as a shift of the escaping light to longer wavelengths and redder colors. Since we think there may be massive black holes at the centers of some galaxies, this is a conceivable explanation of their red shifts. However, the particular spectral lines observed are often characteristic of very thin, diffuse gas and not the astonishingly high density that must prevail near black holes. Or, the red shift might be a Doppler effect due not to the general expansion of the universe, but rather to a more modest and local galactic explosion. But then we should expect as many explosion fragments traveling toward us as away from us, as many blue shifts as red shifts. What we actually see, however, is almost exclusively red shifts no matter what distant objects beyond the local group we point our telescopes to. There is nevertheless a nagging suspicion among some astronomers that all may not be right with the deduction from the red shifts of galaxies via the Doppler effect that the universe is expanding. The astronomer, Halton Arp, has found enigmatic and disturbing cases where a galaxy and a quasar, or a pair of galaxies that are in apparent physical association, have very different red shifts. Occasionally, there seems to be a bridge of gas and dust and stars connecting them. If the red shift is due to the expansion of the universe, very different red shifts imply very different distances. But two galaxies that are physically connected can hardly also be greatly separated from each other, in some cases by a billion light years. Skeptics say that the association is purely statistical, that, for example, a nearby bright galaxy and a much more distant quasar, each having very different red shifts and very different speeds of recession, are merely accidentally aligned along the line of sight, that they have no real physical association. Such statistical alignments must happen by chance every now and then. The debate centers on whether the number of coincidences is more than would be expected by chance. Arp points to other cases in which a galaxy with a small redshift is flanked by two quasars of large and almost identical redshift. He believes the quasars are not at cosmological distances, but instead are being ejected left and right by the foreground galaxy, and that the red shifts are the result of some as yet unfathomed mechanism. Skeptics argue coincidental alignment and the conventional Hubble-Humason interpretation of the red shift. If Arp is right, the exotic mechanisms proposed to explain the energy source of distant quasars, supernova chain reactions, supermassive black holes, and the like, would prove unnecessary. Quasars need not then be very distant, but some other exotic mechanism will be required to explain the red shift. In either case, something very strange is going on in the depths of space. The apparent recession of the galaxies, with the red shift interpreted through the Doppler effect, is not the only evidence for the Big Bang. Independent and quite persuasive evidence derives from the cosmic black body background radiation, the faint static of radio waves coming quite uniformly from all directions in the cosmos at just the intensity expected in our epoch from the now substantially cooled radiation of the Big Bang. But here also, there is something puzzling. Observations with a sensitive radio antenna carried near the top of the Earth's atmosphere in a U-2 aircraft have shown that the background radiation is, to first approximation, just as intense in all directions, as if the fireball of the Big Bang expanded quite uniformly, an origin of the universe with a very precise symmetry. But the background radiation, when examined to finer precision, proves to be imperfectly symmetrical. There is a small systematic effect that could be understood if the entire Milky Way galaxy, and presumably other members of the local group, were streaking toward the Virgo cluster of galaxies at more than a million miles an hour, 600 kilometers per second. At such a rate, we will reach it in 10 billion years, and extragalactic astronomy will then be a great deal easier. The Virgo cluster is already the richest collection of galaxies known, replete with spirals and ellipticals and irregulars, a jewel box in the sky. But why should we be rushing toward it? George Smoot and his colleagues, who made these high-altitude observations, suggest that the Milky Way is being gravitationally dragged toward the center of the Virgo cluster, that the cluster has many more galaxies than have been detected heretofore, and most startling, that the cluster is of immense proportions, stretching across 1 or 2 billion light-years of space. The observable universe itself is only a few tens of billions of light years across, and if there is a vast supercluster in the Virgo group, perhaps there are other such superclusters at much greater distances, which are correspondingly more difficult to detect. In the lifetime of the universe, There has apparently not been enough time for an initial gravitational non-uniformity to collect the amount of mass that seems to reside in the Virgo supercluster. Thus, Smoot is tempted to conclude that the Big Bang was much less uniform than his other observations suggest, that the original distribution of matter in the universe was very lumpy. Some little lumpiness is to be expected, and indeed even needed, to understand the condensation of galaxies. But a lumpiness on this scale is a surprise. Perhaps the paradox can be resolved by imagining two or more nearly simultaneous Big Bangs. If the general picture of an expanding universe and a Big Bang is correct, we must then confront still more difficult questions. What were the conditions like at the time of the Big Bang? What happened before that? Was there a tiny universe devoid of all matter and then the matter suddenly created from nothing? How does that happen? In many cultures, it is customary to answer that God created the universe out of nothing. But this is mere temporizing. If we wish courageously to pursue the question, we must, of course, ask next where God comes from. And if we decide this to be unanswerable, why not save a step and decide that the origin of the universe is an unanswerable question? Or, if we say that God has always existed, why not save a step and conclude that the universe has always existed? Every culture has a myth of the world before creation and of the creation of the world, often by the mating of the gods or the hatching of a cosmic egg. Commonly, the universe is naively imagined to follow human or animal precedent. Here, for example, are five small extracts from such myths at different levels of sophistication from the Pacific Basin. In the very beginning, everything was resting in perpetual darkness. Night oppressed everything like an impenetrable thicket. The great father myth of the Aranda people of Central Australia. All was in suspense and calm, all in silence, all motionless and still, and the expanse of the sky was empty. The Popol Vuh of the Quiche Maya. Na'arien sat alone in space as a cloud that floats in nothingness. He slept not, for there was no sleep. He hungered not, for as yet there was no hunger. So he remained for a great while until a thought came to his mind. He said to himself, "I will make a thing." A myth from Mariana, Gilbert Islands. First, there was the great cosmic egg. Inside the egg was chaos, and floating in chaos was Panku, the undeveloped, the divine embryo. And Panku burst out of the egg, four times larger than any man today, with a hammer and chisel in his hand with which he fashioned the world. The Panku Myths, China, around 3rd century. Before heaven and earth had taken form, all was vague and amorphous. That which was clear and light drifted up to become heaven, while that which was heavy and turbid solidified to become earth. It was very easy for the pure, fine material to come together, but extremely difficult for the heavy, turbid material to solidify. Therefore, heaven was completed first, and earth assumed shape after. When heaven and earth were joined in emptiness, and all was unwrought simplicity, then, without having been created, things came into being. This was the great oneness. All things issued from this oneness, but all became different. Huainan Tzu, China, around 1st century BC. These myths are tributes to human audacity. The chief difference between them and our modern scientific myth of the Big Bang is that science is self-questioning and that we can perform experiments and observations to test our ideas. But those other creation stories are worthy of our deep respect. Every human culture rejoices in the fact that there are cycles in nature. But how, it was thought, could such cycles come about unless the gods willed them? And if there are cycles in the years of humans, might there not be cycles in the eons of the gods? The Hindu religion is the only one of the world's great faiths dedicated to the idea that the cosmos itself undergoes an immense, indeed an infinite, number of deaths and rebirths. It is the only religion in which the timescales correspond, no doubt by accident, to those of modern scientific cosmology. Its cycles run from our ordinary day and night to a day and night of Brahma, 8.64 billion years long, longer than the age of the Earth or the Sun and about half the time since the Big Bang. And there are much longer timescales still. There is the deep and appealing notion that the universe is but the dream of the god who, after 100 Brahma years, dissolves himself into a dreamless sleep. The universe dissolves with him until, after another Brahma century, he stirs, recomposes himself, and begins again to dream the great cosmic dream. Meanwhile, elsewhere, there are an infinite number of other universes, each with its own god dreaming the cosmic dream. These great ideas are tempered by another, perhaps still greater. It is said that men may not be the dreams of the gods, but rather the gods are the dreams of men. In India, there are many gods, and each god has many manifestations. The Chola bronzes, cast in the 11th century, include several different incarnations of the god Shiva. The most elegant and sublime of these is a representation of the creation of the universe at the beginning of each cosmic cycle, a motif known as the cosmic dance of Shiva. The god, called in this manifestation Nataraja, the dance king, has four hands, and the upper right hand is a drum whose sound is the sound of creation, and the upper left hand is a tongue of flame, a reminder that the universe, now newly created, will billions of years from now be utterly destroyed. These profound and lovely images are, I like to imagine, a kind of premonition of modern astronomical ideas. Very likely, the universe has been expanding since the Big Bang, but it is by no means clear that it will continue to expand forever. The expansion may gradually slow, stop, and reverse itself. If there is less than a certain critical amount of matter in the universe, the gravitation of the receding galaxies will be insufficient to stop the expansion, and the universe will run away forever. But if there is more matter than we can see, hidden away in black holes, say, or in hot but invisible gas between the galaxies, then the universe will hold together gravitationally and partake of a very Indian succession of cycles, expansion followed by contraction, universe upon universe, cosmos without end. If we live in such an oscillating universe, then the Big Bang is not the creation of the cosmos, but merely the end of the previous cycle, the destruction of the last incarnation of the cosmos. Neither of these modern cosmologies may be altogether to our liking. In one, the universe is created, somehow, 10 or 20 billion years ago and expands forever, the galaxies mutually receding until the last one disappears over our cosmic horizon. Then, the galactic astronomers are out of business. The stars cool and die, matter itself decays, and the universe becomes a thin, cold haze of elementary particles. In the other, the oscillating universe, the cosmos has no beginning and no end, and we are in the midst of an infinite cycle of cosmic deaths and rebirths with no information trickling through the cusps of the oscillation. Nothing of the galaxies, stars, planets, life forms, or civilizations evolved in the previous incarnation of the universe oozes into the cusp, flutters past the Big Bang, to be known in our present universe. The fate of the universe in either cosmology may seem a little depressing, but we may take solace in the time scales involved. These events will occupy tens of billions of years or more. Human beings and our descendants, whoever they might be, can accomplish a great deal in tens of billions of years before the cosmos dies. If the universe truly oscillates, Still stranger questions arise. Some scientists think that when expansion is followed by contraction, when the spectra of distant galaxies are all blue shifted, causality will be inverted and effects will precede causes. First, the ripples spread from a point on the water's surface, then I throw a stone into the pond. First, the torch bursts into flame, and then I light it.